In this hour, we have a healthcare topic for you, something that we try to do at least one time a year. From time to time on the program, we, in addition to having generalists, kind of general practitioners in different areas, we have people who deal with specialty kind of subjects, and we'll be doing one of those this morning. We'll talk about the feet and care of the foot, and our guest is Dr. Robert Bourne. He's a podiatrist. He's a doctor who specializes in dealing with the foot and the ankle, no higher than that. And he's been good enough to be with us here many times in the past. He's been on the show. And we're pleased to have him here once again to answer questions. I know he will do his best. Every time we have a doctor here, I try to caution people that we can't diagnose over the phone. But we do these shows to try to help you out, give you a place to start, ask some basic questions, add to your health knowledge. And then, of course, if you have a problem, you need to see someone who can see you. But I don't want to discourage anyone from calling. Anybody's welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just pick up the telephone, give us a call. Thank you for being here once again.
My pleasure.
Feet, I came across some statistics, and I think I used them in my promo. It was pretty amazing that the average person takes between 8,000 and 10,000 steps every day, and that there are times when the pressure on your feet exceeds your body weight. So you'd figure, well, okay, it's going to be as much as you weigh, but it's there are sometimes that it's more. And I guess one of the, running, for example, it could pressure on your feet can be three or four times your body weight.
Right. People don't understand that, and that's especially when you're talking about somebody who's, let's say, 200 pounds. You can imagine how much that exerts on the foot. And then, unfortunately, because of the fact that our population is getting heavier and heavier, that weight increases and the forces increase, and you get to the point where it just can't take that much force. So it can be problematic.
Yeah. That's maybe one just real basic thing we do is talk a little bit about shoes. It is possible to buy a very expensive pair of shoes, and I don't know what the cheapest pair of shoes you can buy now is, mm-hmm. But I'm sure that there's a huge range, and obviously some people, they can't, even if they wanted to buy a $300 pair of Mephisto shoes, they would not be able to. How much difference really does it make in the health of your foot and your comfort and your potential for foot problems, what kind of shoe you wear?
I think it's really important in terms of the shoe, but I wonder, I think the construction of the materials are important to a point, but I think the most important thing is fit, making mm-hmm. sure that the shoe actually fits your foot. And I know we've talked about this before, about the fact that the foot changes in size as we get older, not because of the fact that the bones grow, but the ligaments tend to stretch. So we lose some degree of the arch height, and you can imagine, as that happens, the foot will elongate and get wider as a result of that. Gravity is not our friend in those particular cases, so we do have a tendency to have that happen. I see patients all the time who are in shoes that are very short for them. They have particular problems that are related to that, and they don't understand about the fact that since they have the same size that they wore when they were 16 years old, and now they're 68, and why should they have a different size shoe? So I think that's the most important thing. The other factor is the fact that we never have anybody measure feet anymore. Mm-hmm. We're very seldom will you go to a shoe store and have somebody actually sit down and measure your feet. And I think this is something that should be done, and certainly measure both feet. So obviously, we're not as symmetricals would like to believe, and they should both be measured. And especially at the end of the day, it's a little bit better to go ahead and have your feet measured and buy shoes at the end of the day when you have some swelling. And everybody does swell as a result of gravity down to those particular areas. And sometimes that can be a factor when you talk about shoes, because the other thing, one of my pet peeves about shoes is the fact that it'd be nice if they all had a volume rating as well as a particular size. Because mm-hmm. you can imagine, you've seen different styles of shoes, that a size 7 isn't necessarily as voluminous as another size 7. And people have thin feet, large feet, thick, and so it'd be nice if they had a volume rating so you could say that you can't fit 10 pounds in a 5-pound sack, so that you know what kind of volumes there were to get in, that were available inside of that particular shoe for your foot. But yeah. So far, no one's come up with that that system.
Well, another problem is that there are people just aren't symmetrical,
no. And
people's feet are not the same size. So what happens if you have a little difference in size, when you go out and buy a pair of shoes, there you ask for nines, they're both going to be nine. You can't right. buy one 9 and one 9.5.
That's very true. Usually the half size isn't too bad. I always fit the larger foot, but the half size, well, the full size, it gets to be a problem. And there's another niche for you. You could go ahead and start a internet business.
Set up a website.
Oh, yes, for mismatched feet.
I'm surprised that someone hasn't actually done that.
I would think there would be, but as of yet, I haven't found any.
Well, are there very many people whose feet could there could be a whole size difference between?
Yes. Yeah.
So that's not uncommon at all.
No, we have still patients who have post polio patients, or one side did not develop, and with the equal size, that can have sometimes two sizes difference. It'd be nice to be able to find a mate that has the other foot the opposite
way. So you could buy shoes together.
Yes.
Exactly.
Otherwise, it does get quite expensive. If you're buying a pair of shoes that are $150 or $200, then you're going to have to buy two pair.
Yeah. Well, we're here and would be very happy to answer your questions. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. Robert Bourne. He's a podiatrist from Carl Clinic. Questions, welcome here. We'll go right to the first in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask what the latest and greatest is on toe fungus, nail fungus, both topical and systemic treatments. And for me, it's my two big toes, and I'll listen off the air.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. It's a stubborn problem, and we've talked about this, I'm sure, in the past. What's new? Is there anything new?
Not a heck of a lot. There's there still the oral medications that are available. In terms of their degree of effectiveness, is still about 60% in terms of what's called clinical cure rate. You have to be suspicious, or I should say, have to be careful with reading the literature with the drug companies in regards to what they call cure rates, because of the fact that if they have two things. One is mycologic cure and one's clinical cure. Mycologic cure means that you cannot culture the fungus off the nail bed after using the medication for a prescribed period of time. The nail may look exactly the same it was when you started, but there's no fungus there, so therefore it's a mycologic cure. So to the doctor and the patient, doesn't make any difference. Obviously, it's the same as it was, but the statistics show that, put in the column as a cure rate. The other is clinical cure, meaning that you go ahead and you take a look at it, and clinically the nail is clear. It is normal in terms of its appearance and thickness, et cetera. And when you look at the rates of success in using the medication, that's one of the things you have to be careful with. And the mycologic cure rates of some of these medications is very high, but the clinical cure rate is lower. So still, it's something that does not necessarily work for everyone. The big toenails are the ones that are the hardest to go ahead and clear. The medication itself is still, I think it's a reasonably safe medication, but it has to be followed closely for liver function. And the cost, though, is still an issue. Originally, when we first started talking about these, I mean, they were pretty expensive. Now they're even more expensive. So you're talking about close to $800 for the course of use of the medication, and and some insurance companies pay for it, others don't. I think it's fine, but still, majority of the time, it's a cosmetic problem versus anything else. The topical medications have really not been found to be very successful. Penlac is one of the medications that's a nail lacquer that's placed upon the nail. You have to use it for 48 weeks. Not a lot of people are disciplined enough to be able to do that for that long of a period of time. Some of the other topical medications I've heard everything from Vicks salve to turpentine or tea tree oil, all these particular things, I've never seen any real good hard data that they're very successful in treating those particular problems either.
Yeah. So the bottom line is, for anything that you put on the nail, it just doesn't get to where the problem is.
That is the case, yeah.
So. Okay, well, I guess that's the best answer we can give. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller next listening in Decatur, and that's line two. Hello.
Yes, my question is about plantar warts. I've been using salicylic acid creams available from Walmart and all, and it's not really helping. And I was wondering if you can suggest something else about them, and I'll listen to your answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, plantar warts, first off, are there a viral infection, human papilloma viral infection of the skin itself? There's something that is sometimes very difficult to treat. In children, frequently we see them most, and in adults a little bit less. In children, we tend to not be too aggressive in terms of treatment because usually their immune system is a little underdeveloped, and it will eventually go ahead and recognize this virus as being a foreign invader, and it will go ahead and get rid of the lesion itself. If it's real symptomatic and painful, we'll go ahead and use some topical medications on it to try to help decrease the thickness of the callus material on it that makes it painful. In adults, I'm still convinced that, again, it's the same situation where there's an immune deficiency and that you don't recognize this particular virus as being a foreign invader. And what you're trying to do with all the wart treatments is trying to stimulate that immune system to recognize that foreign invader and go ahead and get rid of it. So whether you use a topical acid, you use liquid nitrogen to freeze it, you go ahead and use a hyphricator to go ahead and burn it off, or you use a laser to go ahead and get rid of it, you're trying to kind of do the same thing. I think that for a majority of the times, if the salicylic acid has not worked, then it's worthwhile to go ahead and make an appointment to see someone in regards to treatment of it. There's a lot of different treatments for warts. The only problem is the fact that since there are so many, there's not one great one. It just which one is the favorite of the particular practitioner is usually the go ahead and best one to use. We've been using lately is actually for warts that are very difficult to get rid of. They've been there for many years. We've been using a new particular type of laser. It's a pulse dye laser, and what we've been doing with it is to go ahead and treat the warts. And the way the laser actually works is to go ahead and focus on the blood supply to the wart itself and go ahead and destroy it. So secondarily, the wart just dies off as a result of lack of blood supply. And it's been working reasonably well.
Okay. To the next caller, and that's Lafayette, line number 4.
Hello. Mm-hmm. For a couple of years now, I've had to wear every day a cotton ball between the first and second toes, both feet actually, to keep those two toes from chafing each other. It's reasonably successful in relieving the pain, but short of surgery, will I have that condition for the rest of my life?
First, let me ask you a couple of things. One is, what's the position of your big toe? Is it pretty straight, or is it the second toe that's coming over to the big toe?
The big toe is mainly crooked a bit.
Okay. Usually, in most of those situations, it's obviously a deviation of one or both of the toes that causes that particular problem. If you notice that if you stand barefoot and you load the foot with weight and those two toes immediately come together, then most likely, yes, you're going to be with that particular problem forever. With the exception of trying to put something in between the big toe and the second toe to separate them, as you do with the cotton ball, there are some things that are more effective than the cotton to actually act as a barrier so that they don't come together at the tip. Usually, is where they tend to chafe. The other is obviously if there's a problem with the orientation and the alignment of the toes, then ultimately surgery is the only thing you can do to alter that. There's no stretching exercises or things of that nature that can be done for it. For in between the toes, there's a little silicone rubber type of toe separator that we use actually after bunion surgery to kind of maintain the position of the toes for a period of time as patients recover. That works very well for those particular problems. It's non-irritating to the skin. It's soft enough to be able to wear in a shoe without any problems, and it usually works pretty well for that. The other thing is the toe box of the shoe and shape of the shoes that you put your foot in to make sure they're rounded enough so they don't go ahead and pinch the toes together to aggravate that situation.
Well, they do only after the cotton ball is in there.
Mm-hmm.
Can I get the separator you mentioned?
Yeah, it's available at pretty much any of the drugstores. You would just ask for one of these. It's a silicone toe separator.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Thanks. I don't know if that's true for this particular caller, but it does get back to the kind of the issue we're talking about shoes and about fit and about the fact that we could go out and we could get a whole bunch of different brands of shoes and we'd say, oh, give me a nine. Give me a nine medium. So we look at all these shoes, and they would all in the box, they would all say that they were the same size.
Right.
But if you look at the way that shoe is shaped and at things like particularly like what's the toe look like, they're all going to be different. And we could some we could put on people and they'd say, and I'd say, you know, go ahead and wiggle your toes around there. Do you have plenty of toe room? And say, hey, sure. Great. No problem.
Mm-hmm.
And others that also, it's a nine medium, they could say, man, I feel really pinched in there because it all has to do with how the person who designed that shoe, I guess what it was they decided they wanted it to look like.
Sure. And also the fact that you remember that people are different. I mean, you have feet that certainly look a lot different in terms of their shape. We have people that we call Fred Flintstone feet, and you know their big toe is as long as their fifth toe, so their feet are very square.
Yeah.
So you can imagine trying to put somebody has a very square foot into a shoe that has a toe box that is very pointed and narrow. It may be perfectly fine where the foot is wide in the metatarsal area, but if it tapers down, they're going to have a problem. I've got women who come in and their feet, and they have no problem with dress shoes because their feet are pointed. It's amazing how they were just made for that particular shoe, so they have no problems wearing dress shoes at all. But as I said, this all has a lot to do with matching the shape of the patient's foot to the shape of the shoe.
Yeah. Okay. Line one is up next, and that would be caller in Urbana. Hello.
Yes. I have a question about plantar fasciitis, which I am presently trying to cope with. And what are some of the best solutions for handling plantar fasciitis? Mine is located basically in the heel, and I have heard everything from elevation to rolling your foot on a large can to, I would just like to know if I have found the best relief in getting a molded shoe. And other than that, I was wondering if there's any other way that I could activate a quicker cure with this problem. I'll listen on the radio.
Okay.
Well, first off, plantar fasciitis, that's plantar because that's the bottom of the name for the term for the bottom of the foot, is a inflammation of one or more of the parts of the plantar fascia. The plantar fascia actually has three components to it. And the central portion, which is the hard and fibrous band, is one that's usually mostly affected. A lot of different causes for inflammation of the plantar fascia, overuse because of people walking too much, exercising too much, increase in weight. There's some that feel as though it's an inflammatory process where it just can become inflamed as a result of the stress and strain of where soft tissues attach to bone. These are called enthesopathies. And so there can be, let's say, no rhyme or reason why it starts. In terms of treatment, most of the time we try to take the stresses off the attachment of the plantar fascia where it attaches into the heel, and you do that by going ahead and supporting it. One of the big things to stay away from is walking barefoot, which a lot of times people do much more than they might think, especially in the house. So we recommend utilizing either supportive sandal or a shoe around the house. The other component is tightness in some of the muscle groups, especially the calf muscle. Stretching exercises are very important for that as well. When you talk about rolling of the can or things of that nature, you're trying to go ahead and increase the blood flow through the structures of the foot and in the plantar fascia to try to help them heal. Oral anti-inflammatories, cortisone injections, immobilization in a cast. A lot of times you have to do different things to try to cure this problem, and frequently we have patients that it'll go away very quickly, and other times it'll take months and months to go away, and sometimes it'll just go away as quickly as it comes, and it's a difficult problem. It's very common. It's probably the most common problem that we see as far as patients. The other interesting factor is the fact that I've been in practice for 25 years, and I don't know why it's been such a epidemic over the last 10 years. First years in practice, I would see maybe three or four cases of plantar fasciitis in a month, and I will see easily 10 to 15 a day now. And it's very strange why that is the case, but I can't figure that out why.
Okay. We're about midpoint here through this hour, Focus 580, with Dr. Robert Bourne. He's a podiatrist from Carl Clinic. And if you have questions about the feet, that's what we're talking about. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Villa Grove, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
First of all, I'll say what a timely program, at least for me. I was just getting ready to call my family physician. What I've got is a pain in my foot. It's right in front of my heel, like towards the front of my foot, and it just started Saturday. I was kind of standing around. I wasn't really doing anything strenuous, and I just thought I'd been standing too long, but it's just continually gotten somewhat worse. It doesn't seem to matter whether I'm walking, rather I'm sitting in the evening resting. It's woke me up in the evenings, and I haven't done anything that I thought would have strained the foot, other than a week prior to this, I took a pretty good fall. I fell about 4 feet through the engine hatch of my boat. And at the time, I didn't think I'd hurt anything, but would it be possible that I did some kind of an injury to my foot and it took a week for it to show up?
It's certainly possible. Let me ask you a couple things. One, when you first get up in the morning, is it pretty uncomfortable to try to walk on it?
Yes, it is.
Is it get a little bit better as you walk over a few steps, or stay sore?
No, I would say it loosens up a little bit, but like I say, I can still feel it.
When you're sitting around, you said it tends to wake you up at night, being real painful.
Yeah, the last couple of nights it's woke me up at night, just kind of a throbbing pain, like right in the center bottom of my foot.
Well, that's a little suspicious. Most of the time, you're kind of talking about as we were talking with the other caller about problems with the plantar fascia, but plantar fasciitis is typically not painful when you're off your foot. And in your case, with a history of a fall, you might be looking at some other problems. So that'd be something I would definitely go ahead and see somebody about to rule out other problems.
Okay. All right. Yeah, you can't physically see anything. There's no bruising of the foot, and it doesn't hurt to push on it or anything like that.
Well, as I said, when somebody who has some idea what they're looking for examines it, frequently a patient comes in, it doesn't hurt when I press on it, and I go ahead and touch it, and they're to the ceiling. A lot of times it's something just certainly to rule out, especially when somebody has had a fall. You can do everything from either to have a bruise of the bone in that particular area that after continuing to walk on it may turn into a fracture or a stress fracture of that particular area. To some other problems with ligament damage. So it's something since it seems to be getting somewhat worse, certainly it has to be looked at.
Okay, that's what I'll do then.
Okay.
All right, thanks for the call. Uh-huh. We have certainly plenty of time for other folks who are listening. If you have questions, again, that number, it's 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Just recently, I rediscovered or was aware again of the Urshu. Now, maybe the Urshu really never went away. Maybe some people, they will remember, I remember the Urshu. It was something that was very popular in the 1970s. And mm-hmm. The thing about the shoe is that they've built it so that your heel is lower than the toe.
Right.
It's what they call a negative heel shoe.
Right.
And I guess the idea is that that's supposed to have some positive effect on your posture.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that really is true or not. But and I remember, they were very popular for a while and then they sort of went away and just recently. And I say maybe they've never gone away completely, but I just recently noticed that they were back.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that shoe?
I guess the shape of the shoe is very nice because it's kind of the shape of a foot, so that's always a benefit. But the fact that it has a negative heel is, is great for somebody who has excellent flexibility as far as their Achilles tendon is concerned, their calf muscles. But if they have some tightness in that particular area, then they're going to run into trouble. because we talked about, you know, plantar fasciitis, and one of the main causes for the plantar fasciitis is the fact that the foot tends to flatten out to some degree when you stand on it. You lose the normal integrity of the arch, and now the plantar fascia has to prevent the foot from flattening out when someone stands on it. And this is something that can happen with tightness of the structures in the back of the leg. And this would just exacerbate that particular problem. So in we had seen when earth shoes were more popular, we would see patients who say, boy, you know, I had problems with my feet. I went and got these shoes because I thought they'd help me out. Now I'm 10 times worse than I was. And then we'd spend time trying to lift the heel to decrease the pull on the Achilles tendon.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, I think they're fine for people who don't have any tightness and they're a decent shoe in terms of shape of the toe box. I haven't seen one in a long, long time. I guess they are still available. But, you know, again, I think that you know, in general they're okay, but that's I wouldn't go out of my way to actually purchase any.
Well, now it seems that there are more manufacturers whose selling point is comfort.
Right.
Shoes that are going to not only look good, but be really comfortable, particularly if you have to spend a lot of time on your feet or if you're going to do a lot of walking. And it is possible, certainly, to buy shoes that do look like dress shoes that pretty much that he's given me this look like, oh, yeah, which indeed might be one of the complaints that people have. You know, they feel that they have to have a shoe or they want a shoe that looks a particular way, but you know, they don't want their feet to hurt. So I mean,
sure.
what do you do
for
when
men's
you,
shoes? That's fine. I mean, a lot of times you can go ahead and do that, but unfortunately,
I guess that's really
shoes,
what I was thinking. I was thinking about men's shoes.
No.
Yes. No. Yeah. That's right.
No. Women's shoes. It's still a
style and comfort. You might as well forget those.
It's still very, very difficult for both the patient and the practitioner when the patient comes in and says, you know, my feet are killing me, and you look at the shoes that they're wearing and say, you know, I'm not surprised.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and shoes don't necessarily cause every problem. They certainly can make things worse. You know, there are problems with structural abnormalities of the foot, mechanical abnormalities of the foot. But unfortunately, we do have to put them in something to walk around. And where women's shoes are a problem is that especially if we're trying to go ahead and adjust the mechanics of the foot by utilizing, let's say, a support inside the shoe that's specially designed to do that. Now we have to go ahead and find something that will fit the support, have enough room in the shoe then to fit the patient's foot at the same time, and the appropriate shape so that it doesn't jam the toes or foot together. And the unfortunate part is that that shoe will probably end up looking like a foot. Now, if you think about the styling that women's shoes have, usually they don't look like feet. And so how are you going to go ahead and get that foot inside of that shoe that doesn't look like a foot? And it's a huge dilemma. So we can go ahead and help out, but frequently that the patient can't wear it or won't wear the shoe that would be best for them. And you know, again, men's shoes. There's plenty of shoes that are available out there that will easily be able to handle anything that we do. But the women's shoes still, it's a terrible problem.
Okay. Well, we had some other callers here. Let's talk with them. And first in line would be a caller in Arcola, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, about 8 years ago, I was horsing around in the house with my dog, and he was chasing me, and I turned around to see where he was at, and I ran my foot into the door jamb, and I broke my toe, the one next to the little toe. And my wife said, well, there's nothing they can do about it, you know, as far as casting or anything. So we taped it. And I didn't keep the tape on it real long enough, and it healed kind of crooked. And now I'm developing a callus underneath there, and I have to trim it off every now and then. Is there any way that I can should I start taping it again, or is it just going to be like that for?
It's how long has it been since the injury?
About 8 years.
That's about it. That's what you got. And you know, there'd be no way to go ahead and do anything with it short of usually take an X-ray, seeing what the position of the bone is, you know, examining it to see what the problem may be. Again, surgically, there's something that you can usually do in these cases for removing the, you know, say portion of bone that is causing the problem, because the callus usually is secondary to the fact that the skin is getting pinched in between the bone on one side and the shoe on the other.
Yeah.
And frequently people think, well, can't you just cut that thing out? Well, if you did, then the new skin would do the same thing because the skin is the innocent bystander. So, yeah, something could be done with it, but it would most likely...
It doesn't cause me any pain or anything. It's just kind of a hassle sometimes. I mean, I can feel it on there sometimes because it's bent underneath the other toe. That's, that's where it...
Yeah, and that's and also sometimes in those cases, you didn't necessarily fracture the bone, but the ligament might have torn.
Yeah.
And so you,
well,
you lose
the stability. Well, it turned black after a couple of days. I think I did break it.
Yeah. So, no, unfortunately, that's what you got.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go back here to Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'm glad you're discussing plantar fasciitis because I think I have a condition that I think is related to a bout of plantar fasciitis that I had. I'm not sure if it's related to walking funny to ease the pain. Now I have pain in the heel, specifically in the heel bone and to either side, and it seems to be eased if I keep the foot at a right angle.
Okay. Does the pain in the heel, is it kind of radiate like a horseshoe area around the back of the heel or bottom?
No, actually it seems to be really located right on the heel bone. If you press on the
bottom or the top or
the back.
The back of the heel.
Yeah.
Where the Achilles tendon attaches?
Yeah. I'm not having pain in the tendons at all, but like the soft tissue on either side of the heel.
Yeah.
That's kind of painful, and like I said, if you press hard on the bone, there's a pain associated with that.
That's something, you're right, if you had the plantar fasciitis for a long enough period of time, adjusting your gait, it might have caused other problems as well, but that's something that it would have to be examined to see exactly what's going on in that particular case. I'd hate to offer a recommendation when I really wouldn't know exactly what the problem might be.
Is there anything, I mean, like I said, it seems to be diminished quite a bit if I can keep my foot at more of a right angle instead of lengthening your foot like you would when you're sleeping. That seems to be helping it a bit because it has been easing off in the last few weeks.
Yeah. You know, again, it could be just problems with inflammation where the Achilles tendon attaches to it as well.
Okay. Would there be swelling associated with that? Because it
not
looks
necessarily
pretty normal.
No, frequently you don't see much in terms of swelling.
Okay.
So that may be the case. But again, I'd hate to offer an opinion.
Okay. I mean, I talked to my doctor and he had, you know, based on the symptoms that I had diagnosed the plantar fasciitis a few months ago. I mean, is this something that I should go back and have him take a look at, or should I just, you know, kind of wait it out a little bit longer? It's not, you know, horribly painful, but...
How many weeks have you had it?
Two or three.
I'd probably give it another 2 or 3 weeks and see how it does.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
All right, okay. Thank you. Let's go to another Urbana caller, line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh. I broke my small toe about 3 weeks ago. And it's been pretty painful. It got really ugly, and it's pretty sore. And I was wondering, I just assumed that I didn't need to go to the doctor because there's nothing the doctor could really do about it, and that it would just heal up. But I wanted to see if that was right. Should I go and have it looked at, or should I just let it heal and assume that there's nothing the doctor could do about it anyway?
Well, does it just hurt when you press on the toe itself or back behind it?
Well, I think it's the toe is, I don't know. It doesn't hurt. I don't think it got broken behind the toe. I don't think it's the foot bone there.
And then the alignment of the toe is pretty reasonably straight?
Well, no, it's not. I mean, when I first broke it, it was kind of off a little bit to the right, and then I've been wearing my tennis shoes because I figured it needed to be kept in one place rather than wearing my sandals and moving all over the place, so it went back a little bit, but it's not bad. It doesn't look like my other toe.
Right. Frequently, it's one of those things I'll see patients sometimes for, you know, these problems or people call, and it's something that I always have them come in and take an x-ray to take a look at it.
Oh,
number
really?
Number one, sometimes we'll have people who think they broke their toe and they didn't, or those who think they just might have stubbed it and was just a little bruise and they have quite a break. One of the reasons we like to know if it's fractured or not is then to give the patient an idea that, okay, you know, it's broken. It should go ahead and it's in decent alignment. It'll heal eventually, but it'll stay sore for a good 6 or 8 weeks. So then you give some idea of what to expect out of that particular problem.
Yeah, well,
so,
I'm pretty sure it's broken.
Well,
I was just wondering if...
Pretty sure is one thing and knowing for sure is another. But
so you think I should just... clarify the issue.
Yeah, it depends also how much it's bothering you. If you say that, well, in 3 weeks, obviously it's still going to be sore, but is it getting a lot better in 3 weeks than it was? And if not, then I'd go ahead and have them take a quick x-ray and take a look at it.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
Well, now we've talked to two different people who said that they thought they had broken a toe and felt that there was no point in going to the doctor because there was nothing that you could do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that true? If you have a toe break, you don't splint it or do anything,
right?
As I said,
most of the time you check and see if it is broken. Okay. And as the reasons I said before, also to check the alignment and there are some tape splinting procedures that you can do with them that certainly make it more comfortable. I'm almost more worried sometimes when we have those areas of the ligament damage to the joint, because we see deviation of those particular toes as a result, like the other caller was saying about, you know, years later, and then it forms a problem then. It's not saying that we can prevent that, but certainly we'd like to try and to make sure we check for stability of the toe, stability of the joint and the ligaments around that area, and again to make sure that if it is a fracture that it's in decent alignment and it should heal, and if it's not then we can go ahead and even if it is fractured to splint it, make it a little bit more comfortable. Mm-hmm. Usually use a post-op shoe as well to try to accommodate things, and yes, there are some things that can be done for you. Just don't say no, we don't bother to treat it. As I said, most of the fractures will heal without any problems. But I think it's worthwhile to, if somebody's really concerned about it, to have it taken a look at.
So on average, how long a healing time would you expect on something like that?
Well, it depends on the toe, too. Mm-hmm. If it's the fifth toe, it's going to be a little bit more problematic in terms of being painful in a shoe. So in terms of actually healing time so it doesn't hurt anymore, a lot of times it's going to be 6-8 weeks to go ahead and have that calm down. The other toes, second through fourth, that are kind of locked in, those with tape splinting, a lot of times they'll be much better in 4 to 6 weeks.
All right. Next caller here, Terre Haute, line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. I am calling about a 7-year-old grandson who seems to be always running and walking up on his toes. His heel does not come down to touch the ground. And I'm wondering if the parents should be doing some corrective measures or seeing someone. We went to his baseball game a week ago, and he's even running the bases and running the field on his toes. Is there something wrong here?
Well, certainly it's not a normal type of gait, and we see that in children sometimes.
I cannot hear you.
Well, maybe we'll try and turn the things up a little bit on our end. Is that better?
I will have to take my answer off the air because I can't hear you.
Okay. Well, we'll give you your answer that way. And if you want to call back and ask another question, you may. Well, okay. Why don't you go ahead?
Certainly, it's a problem in children sometimes as far as toe walkers, and again they have to be evaluated to see exactly why they're doing that. Is it a problem of congenitally short calf muscles and Achilles tendon that they literally can't get their heel down to the ground? Is it a behavioral type of thing where sometimes kids just like to walk on their toes and they have normal range of motion? You certainly like to discourage that particular type of activity. So that, you know, again, it has to be evaluated. Or is it a neurological problem where they might have a muscle weakness? So yes, it's something that is not normal and certainly should be evaluated by, you know, the pediatrician should be able to look at it, and then to go ahead and make appropriate referral, depending on what the problem may be, to either a pediatric orthopedist or podiatrist based on what the problems may be.
And if that was something that you just let go, was it is potential for causing problems?
Well, you know, certainly if it's a neuromuscular problem, you'd certainly like to catch it earlier than later. And if it is indeed a problem with, let's say, tightness in the Achilles tendon, et cetera, you'd like to go ahead and be able to address that versus having the child learn how to compensate for that problem.
All right. Urbana, line one is next. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. Recently I noticed solid or semi-solid node on the top of my left foot. Somewhere over the metatarsals, I guess. And I had it checked out by a local physician who kind of gave a vague answer saying it was some sort of cyst. And just to be sure, we took an x-ray. It was non-bony. But I was kind of curious about where these might come from and maybe more importantly, you know, if this is will be a recurring thing or I guess I'd just like some more information about this sort of thing.
Okay. Most of the time on the top of the foot and also the top of the hand where the skin is very thin and there's not much padding and there's some tendons over that or underlying the skin in those areas, we can frequently develop what are called ganglion cysts. And what these actually are little outpouchings of the tendon sheaths over the tendons that they form secondary to an injury to these areas. Usually it's a crush type of injury where you'll drop something on your foot, and this may have happened a long, long time ago, and you can't necessarily recall it, or you're just walking in the middle of the night and whack the chair leg or something of that nature. And what you can do is injure these areas, weaken the wall of the tendon sheath. And then because of the fact that the tendon sheath produces fluid to lubricate tendons, this fluid then can start to leak out or balloon in this particular area of the weakness in the wall of the tendon sheath and form a cyst. Now, it's interesting because then the lining of the cyst itself also has the ability to produce fluid. These cysts frequently will change in size, and this is one of the reasons why you kind of know that it's a fluid-filled area versus a soft tissue mass that, let's say, is solid, because they will go ahead and can empty and fill, and also they can grow at a very rapid rate because they can increase the size of the amount of fluid in it. The usual thing is it comes from the tendon sheath. Also, it can come from a joint as well. So you can have a arthritic change in a joint that can also go ahead and have the lining of the joint produce the same phenomenon where you have a little stalk and a cyst associated with it. Most of the times these are diagnosed as a result of just the exam. X-rays are not going to show that particular area. You can do an ultrasound test to see if there is fluid in that particular area versus a hard mass. Frequently, treatment would be either observation of it and just make sure you don't wear a shoe that irritates the top of it, to aspiration of the cyst, meaning you go ahead and use a little local anesthetic, numb up the skin, use a needle to go ahead and draw the fluid out of that particular area. But these have a tendency to reoccur when you do that. So sometimes if they're a problem, then surgery is necessary to go ahead and remove the cyst, try to find the source of the stem, and then go ahead and repair it. They can be problematic because they can reoccur as well.
Okay.
So,
all right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. And next caller here is in Mattoon, line number two. Hello.
Thank you, doctor. About 2 months ago, I had a pedicure, and I had my toenails painted, which I don't usually do. The next time I had a pedicure, the polish was removed, and I found that I had a black toenail on my big toe. Now, last week, when I had another pedicure, the pedicurist said that my nail was loose on that toe. Now, I also have very poor circulation in my toes, and I wonder what to do about that loose nail, if anything.
Well, if you have poor circulation, then you really need somebody to look at it to make sure there's nothing going on underneath the nail.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have pretty good sensation in your feet? You can feel your skin well?
Not very well, no. Mm.
You know, that's as I said, is a little bit of a concern, where why is the toenail black? Frequently would we have in these situations where someone had pressure on the area of the toenail, and that it will go ahead and have a little blood blister underneath the nail.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's what causes the black color, is actually the blood, and then you get separation of the nail plate from the nail bed as a result of that resolving. Now, it's sometimes important, if the nail is significantly loose, to go ahead and remove the loose piece of nail, because you don't want it to act as a irritant as it moves and it rubs against the nail bed when you're wearing a shoe.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think that in your particular case, yes, that needs to be looked at. Loose portion of the nail probably removed, assessed to make sure that there's no problem with the nail bed underneath.
I see.
And that would be the best thing to do.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Somebody wants to call real quick. We can probably get one more call in before we end up out of time. Off and on during the course of the show, we've talked about some of the problems that people can have with their feet, either discomfort or worse, with shoes that are not properly fitted. And it is certainly the case that there are places you can go where the people who sell you your shoes take great care to try to fit properly. And then, of course, it's also possible, you know, go someplace where it's up to you.
Right.
So I guess if you decide that you're going to do that, or even if you're, you know, looking at shoes and trying to decide, well, do I want this pair or this pair or this pair, mm-hmm. are there particular things that you'd say people, it'd be good to look at, to think about when they're picking out a pair of shoes, just when they're, you know, they're holding that shoe in their hand and they're
right.
looking at it and thinking, okay, is this good or not?
Well, it depends on what they're buying the shoe for. I'm pretty much a believer in specialty shoes, and so if somebody's going to buy a pair of shoes for a particular sporting activity, or they're going to just want a pair of shoes to walk in, you know, they should be looking for a shoe, let's say, that has some decent stiffness in the heel counter, which is the back portion of the shoe where the heel sits in the shoe. It should have the ability to go ahead and hold the heel in its proper position, which is kind of upright and perpendicular to the weight-bearing surface. That should be stiff there, and the shoe should be flexible in the ball of the foot where the toes actually bend, and it should be very flexible in that particular area so that you can go ahead and take one finger and push up on the toe of the shoe, and it should bend in the spot where your foot bends and not behind that. That's what you see in a lot of shoes, even expensive ones, where they will actually bend in the middle of the arch portion of the shoe, and that's not where you need it to bend. So it should be flexible where your foot is flexible, and then behind that area it should be rather stiff so that it cannot bend in the area of the arch. In bending, as well as what's called torsional rigidity, where you try to twist the shoe, and you should not be able to twist the shoe like a pretzel. It should have some stiffness to it so it doesn't do that. So those are the things that you look for in a pair of shoes. And that's usually you can have a shoe that is pretty inexpensive and pass those tests, and it's fine. Whereas sometimes a more expensive shoe will not pass those tests, and it's not near as good as the cheaper shoe.
Okay, very good. Let's get Urbana here, one caller, before we end up out of time. Line number one.
Me?
Yes.
Good morning. Less than a year ago, when I was trimming my toenail, big toe, of course, I did something that it caused the nail fall down after a few months, of course. Now it's almost 90% of it has grown back. But in the middle, it's a little higher. Of course, I have been using, trimming it a little on it. But what do you think? Do you think that I should do something else, or that just let it grow the way that it is?
Does the nail plate itself look pretty clear? There's no evidence of discoloration or anything like that?
No, just the top part of it that it's growing. That has a little...
I would say just leave it go the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because as we realize, you know, the nail grows from a growth center that's behind where the skin meets the nail. And whatever the shape that's in, it will produce a nail of that particular shape. And so really there's not much we can do that will actually affect the growth of the nail after it's grown out and formed the hard keratin plate. So if it's growing out reasonably well, I'd just leave it alone and leave it at that.
But that middle doesn't need, I trim it a little, you see it go on it and use the...
I would, the least that you do for it. If it's a little thick, you can go ahead and file it a little bit, but make sure that you don't do it too much, that you'll go right through the nail plate to the nail bed.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. Well, I guess for this time around, we'll finish up. I thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
Dr. Robert Bourne, he's a podiatrist from Carle Clinic.